Okay. Tonight's main speaker is Diana M., who comes to us from Eastside AA, which meets Tuesdays at 5:30, right?
So, welcome. Thank you.
I'm Diana. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 5/21/21, and I just met a lady this evening who has the same sobriety date as me, so that's super cool. I've never had that. So I like to kind of skip my life story, and I go straight to the first time I had a drink. And I was a late teen, and my sister gave me a shot, and I drank it. And after a couple minutes, I said, I don't feel anything. And she goes, you're not supposed to feel anything. And I said, well, why do we drink it then? She's like, I don't know. And ever since then, to me, alcohol was to feel something different. And as soon as I felt that way, that was the new normal. My disease was progressive from the get-go, albeit it was slowly for quite a few years. But as soon as I hit a milestone with my drinking career, that was the new normal. I never went backwards because I didn't want to. So as it does, it progressed pretty severely in my late 20s. And my now husband and I used to play video games, and we would drink while we played. And one day he came up to me and he said, do you think we're drinking too much? And I said, we probably could cut back a little. And he goes, yeah, we should just try cutting back for a little. Absolutely. Well, he cut back, but I didn't. And when he cut back and I didn't, it started to become a little more clear how much I was drinking, because when we were both drinking, I could kind of excuse how quickly the bottle went. And so I didn't like that as much. So then I started drinking in the other room. Or I drank box wine because then I didn't see how quickly it was going. I'm very resourceful. So as it kept progressing, I hit January 2020. And I had a friend that drank pretty severely with me. And we decided we were going to have a dry January. And as we're getting closer to January, she's getting a little panicky. And she goes, you know, I have a wedding in January, so maybe we could do dry February. And I said, February is a shorter month. And she goes, well, no, it's just the wedding. And I said, well, you can wait till February, but I'm going to do January. And I remember the look on my husband's face, and he was so proud of me that I knew that I had the courage to do it. I was going to stay sober for a full month. And I did. And I felt awesome. I didn't have headaches. I didn't have joint pain. I didn't have to check my phone when I woke up to see who I got in a fight with. I didn't have to bring food home in the evening to suck up because I was kind of obnoxious the night before. And so I decided, keep it going. So I made a deal with myself that I could drink 3 times that year. And something about that deal helped because every day I wanted to drink, and I could, but it counted as one of my 3 days. So I went from January to May for my birthday. And I drank moderately because I knew I hadn't been drinking. And I stayed sober for another 3 months after that. I'm not an alcoholic, I told everybody. I can control it, I just have to make up my mind. I'm in martial arts, I've run half marathons. I'm a disciplined person, I have a job, a family. When I make my mind up, I can do something. And I just proved to everybody I'm not an alcoholic. And so in August, I went to go visit my friend who was supposed to do the dry January with me, and I decided to drink for the second time. And it was out of state, so I just kind of counted the whole weekend as the second time, right? It was at the end of the month, so then just finish out the month, and that all, the whole week, was my second time. Well, I'm sure you can imagine I didn't stop drinking. And the worst part was is, at first, it was kind of fun to be drinking again, but I started to miss what it was like being sober. And I got panicked because I think part of me knew that I probably had to be done. And so I felt like I needed to drink as much as possible before it was over. And then it got to the part where I wanted to quit and I couldn't. So one day I came home and I brought Chinese food to sweeten the deal because I was drunk. And I went to bed, and I woke up the next day, went to work, and I knew I was in trouble. There had been many times over the years that I had come home drunk, drank too much, and I always waited for my husband to say the A word, And he never did. I always waited for him to call me out on my behavior or the fight I picked, and he never did. And so the morning after, I would always do this damage control. I don't know if you guys have ever Googled how to tell if you're an alcoholic. I'd imagine normal people don't have to do that, but I've done it a couple times. And so I was doing damage control. And I was negotiating with myself. Nobody's telling me I have to stop, but you're acting like an alcoholic. Just don't drink and drive. Don't drink at work. Just have a couple drinks and stop. Otherwise, you're going to have to quit forever. And part of my brain understood that I couldn't. But I still believed in my self-control and my discipline. So I kept doing damage control. And when I got home that day, I had a plan. And so we went on a walk with the dogs, and I started rattling off my plan. And he just sat there. But I knew he was mad, so I was biding my time. And we got home after the walk, and I was like, cool. He doesn't even really seem that mad. And he grabs a piece of paper, and he starts reading this letter to me about how my alcohol makes him feel, how I'm showing up for my daughter, how he never once asked me to stop. He never once told me I had to stop. He never gave me an ultimatum or threatened me with anything. But he did say he couldn't stand there and watch me do this with my life. And when it talks about the gates clamoring shut in the big book, I know what that feels like. So he suggested that I either go to AA or see a therapist. And I said, well, I'll start with AA because I think it's free. And he goes, okay, do you want me to give you the number? And I said, you want me to call right now? And he goes, I don't think this should wait. So I called 1-800, I downloaded the meeting group app, and I found a women's meeting that night. And I said, well, I guess I'll give this a try. And he said, okay. So I start driving to the meeting, and all of a sudden, I am pissed. He can't control me. Who is he to tell me what I can and can't do? And if I have to sit in a room and say, I'm Diana, I'm an alcoholic, like these women, either they're low bottom drunks, and I'm not that. I'm a dignified drunk. Or they won't understand. But I kept driving, and I showed up for the 7 o'clock meeting. And when I got there, there was women sitting out in a circle. And I started walking up, and they could tell that I was new. And they said, are you here for the meeting? And I said, yep, in the 7 o'clock AA meeting. And they said, oh, yeah, it started at 6. And they said, we've been meaning to update the group app. And I'm thinking, great, I came, I tried, I'll just head home. There was 12 girls, 12 women there, and 11 of them decided to stay an extra hour to give me a first step meeting. It was wonderful. And as I'm sitting there, because of course they found out it was my first AA meeting and that I was less than 24 hours sober, they started going one by one over their first step, how they came to believe and understand that they were powerless over alcohol. And the whole time I'm listening to them, and I'm thinking, am I powerless over alcohol? And when it came time for my turn, I started sharing everything with these women. I mean, things that I would never have shared with my husband, even though he lived with my alcoholism every day. And I knew what it was like to be surrounded by people who knew exactly what I was going through. And for the first time, I understood that I was powerless over alcohol. So it was recommended that I get a sponsor, and I grabbed the first lady that I saw, and I said, I don't know what a sponsor is, but will you be mine? And she said, yep. You know, a sponsor is somebody who takes you through the 12 steps and the big book. And I said, awesome. And she goes, can you meet Sunday? And I said, yep. And we started working on the steps right then and there. So I started going to meetings pretty regularly from the get-go. But I was very, very mad. And I came home, and I dramatically threw the big book on the bed because they had an extra big book that they gave me. And my husband goes, what is that? And I said, I don't know, but I guess I have to read it. And he's like, okay. And I just kind of was thinking, like, look what you made me do. You did this to me. So I started going to meetings. And things didn't feel different. Things just felt hard. And even though I knew that I needed to be done, and even though part of me felt relief in that thought and that realization, I wasn't ready for it completely. But I had faith and I had trust, and I just kept doing what people told me to do. So about a month into my sobriety, I had my bachelorette party. I wasn't married quite yet when I got sober. And I went to my bachelorette party, and my sister and I were gossiping. Nobody else was there yet except my sister-in-law, and me and my younger sister were talking about everybody who was about to show up for the bachelorette party. We had to get it out of our system before they showed up. And then we go through the bachelorette weekend, get home, and about a week later, I get a text from my sister-in-law. And she said how bummed it was to listen to me talk about all these women that were coming to support me. And she would have loved to hear all the good things about them that I love. And I was mortified. And first I was pissed. Like, doesn't she know I'm newly sober? I'm dealing with sobriety right now. And who is she on her high horse to talk about, like, nobody gossips? And I did not invite gratitude into my thought process at this point, but I still heard a little voice saying, how do you think she felt having to confront you about your crappy behavior? And how much do you think she loves you that it was more worth it for her to confront you and tell you how she feels than to just go gossip to somebody else about it? And so I responded with a thank you and an apology. And I said, that's not who I want to show up as anymore. And I'm embarrassed, and I'm so grateful that you told me. And she immediately said, I know you're dealing with sobriety. And I said, that's not an excuse. Although it was the one I gave myself first. But all of a sudden, I saw how self-pity can turn to gratitude if I let it. Self-pity is still my default emotion. It's the first thought that comes in my head. But I'm getting quicker and quicker at turning it into gratitude. So now I'm an alcoholic. I'd imagine you guys understand how much self-pity can come just with that word. I don't have alcoholics in my family. I don't even have alcoholics in my friend group. Do I tell people? How do I navigate this? Nobody else understands what it's like to give up something that I wanted so badly. But I can turn that into gratitude. If I am the first one in my family, if I am the first one in my friend group, then I can show them that you can live a happy, joyous life without alcohol. And all of a sudden, I had a purpose. And now that I had a purpose, things at meetings were clicking a little differently, right? I wasn't just not drinking and listening to these messages so that I could stay sober. I had a purpose. I had to set an example of how to live a sober life. So now these meetings and these readings that we were doing every week gave me direction on how to do that. One of the most meaningful things at a meeting that I heard, that's to this day my favorite thing, is on page 14 and 15 from the big book. Faith without works is dead, and how appallingly true for an alcoholic. For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. And I looked at my life and I understood how that principle applied in other areas. Self-knowledge isn't enough. It makes me feel good to understand why I'm an alcoholic, that I have an allergy or spiritual malady. But that's not enough to keep me sober. And it doesn't even keep me spiritually fit most days. And it's just like going to the gym. I can know how to use the gym equipment, but if I don't go in and use it, I'm not going to get any stronger. So I needed to find a way to have action in my program. And I'm grateful that I had people in the meetings that were showing me how to do that. So I knew sponsorship was a huge one, but I was only a couple months sober, so I raised my hand, even though I really didn't know what I had to offer. I just knew I was willing. And nobody asked for quite a while, but that's okay, I kept raising my hand. And I heard people talk about other ways to be of service. And I started looking around my club and I realized somebody has to clean the bathrooms. So I went up to somebody at our meeting, and I asked if I could start cleaning the bathroom. And they looked at me and said, you want to clean the bathrooms? And I said, yeah, I'm looking for service work. They go, oh, how about we start you with coffee duty? And I was like, oh, thank God. Coffee's way better than bathrooms. And the cool thing about coffee is it gets you there early before the meeting. So you get to greet people before the meeting. And when you're going regularly, you start to notice who the newcomers are. And so you're able to greet the newcomers. And I realized and heard that even just going to meetings frequently is a way to be of service. And I think back on that first meeting, how all of those women stayed an extra hour for me. And if I had showed up 5 minutes late, I wouldn't have known that the meeting was at 6 o'clock. I would have thought that I was the only alcoholic. I didn't know there were so many alcoholics in the world. So if I showed up and nobody was there, I would have felt pretty hopeless. And so those women were my first example of service work, how to give selflessly for the newcomer. And I was so eager to do that. So about 6 months in, I got my first sponsee, and I had no idea what to do with her. And I started thinking quickly about all these answers that I thought I had, and I realized I don't have any answers, and I don't need them. All we have to do is read through the big book together, and I get to share what my experience was, and hopefully she'll feel comfortable and share what her experience was. And it was so amazing to be able to work with another person, and like there's some similarities, but then there's not others. So I've quickly found a huge love of working with others. And God has kept me really, really busy. But even if I don't have people to work with, I look for places to try to be of service wherever I can. Because I was a full-time alcoholic, I need to be a full-time person in recovery. My spiritual sickness is there quickly. So sometimes I have to get a little creative. The first time that I went on an airplane, I was thinking about how much I used to love on airplanes. And if you're an alcoholic in Minnesota, are you still an alcoholic in Pennsylvania? It just felt like I'm not really an alcoholic. Who would know if I drank over there? So my brain's already making excuses, right? So the first thing I did was share about it at a meeting, which was embarrassing. You know, I wanted to look like I had it all figured out. I'd been sober over a year. I didn't want people to worry about me. And I realized that was my disease talking and not me. So I shared it at a meeting, and people came up and gave me their experience. And they talked about being of service. Yep, I'm of service all the time. This is great. So I go to my gate, and my gate is right by the bar. And I'm looking back, and I don't want to drink, guys. But I'm just watching the bartender, and I'm watching what they're pouring, and I'm watching who's coming and going. And I'm very fixated on the bar, but I don't want to drink. And I realize this is spiritual sickness. How many times do I sit by bars at restaurants and I'm not thinking about what people are drinking? I don't know what a relapse looks like yet, but I know what spiritual fitness looks like, and I know when I'm not there. And I just don't know how many steps are from there to the relapse. So when I feel that first step, my goal is to get back into my spiritual strength. So I text my sponsor, and she quoted something from the big book, so I pulled up the big book on my phone, and I'm sitting there reading it, and it tells me what I have to do. Extensive work with another alcoholic will save the day, but I'm at an airport. And so I'm looking around, and I'm like, I can find a way to be of service. Just keep looking. And I see some guy cleaning the windows that works there, and he looks pretty miserable. And I go up, and I say, can I get you a candy bar? And he just kind of stares at me. And then he takes an AirPod out and says, what? And I was like, can I get you a candy bar? And he goes, no, I'm good. Thanks, though. And I was like, yep, for sure. And I turn around and I walk off. I go get a sandwich at the cafe, get myself a candy bar. And I sit down. And I'm like, well, that was mortifying. But then I look over at him, and he has a big smile on his face. And I didn't think about the bar the rest of the time I was at the airport. And I found that if I'm willing and if I seek, there's always a way to be of service. The hardest part for me about this program is practicing these principles in all my affairs. I can come to AA. I can work with my sponsor. I can work with other women. And my heart is filled with service work and being there and sobriety. But I have a 16-year-old daughter. And I do not know how to make these principles apply for her. Or my husband. You know, I really think my husband would benefit from AA if he was just willing to do the steps in Al-Anon. And I realize there's a lot of areas in my life where I want to bring those people to AA. I think they'd be happier if they had these principles. But I don't get to choose that. I can bring AA to them. I can bring AA to myself. And so that's what I try to do. But I already told you self-pity is my first default. So the first year that I was sober, my husband was laid off from work. He's a lot more financially stable than I was, so he wasn't panicked about it. He was able to just kind of enjoy a couple months off of not working. And excuse me. It was winter, and he doesn't like it when we drive over the newly snowed-on driveway because it packs it down, turns it to ice. I don't have these high standards like he does. I don't care. But I'm the only one that's leaving because he doesn't work. So guess who has to shovel before they leave? And so one morning, I'm in a rush because I didn't manage my time. I didn't wake up and get everything done that I wanted to. And now I have to shovel? And the whole time I'm shoveling, I'm thinking about, he's laying in bed. Why can't he wake up and shovel? He can go back to bed. Why do I get punished? Because I have to leave to go to work. And I am just spinning the tires on my pity train as fast as they will go. I always forget to mention, this is like the second time I shoveled that whole winter. I really paint my husband out to be a bad guy. He's not. I warn him that I tell this story, so if people give him mean looks, then he knows why. My husband shovels all the time. But this was the second time I shoveled, and I hated it. So all of a sudden, I think, do I even have room in my brain or in my heart to believe anything else right now? Or is my case sealed and shut? Am I even willing to feel differently? Well, of course, I don't want to be mad. I don't want to be mad at him. He's doing this to me. It would just be great if he could do X, Y, Z. And I heard a voice in my head that said, do you want a happy marriage or do you want an equal marriage? Well, I want a happy marriage. Of course I want a happy marriage. And the voice said, you're not picking a happy marriage right now. I don't know what his tank looked like that day or even that month or that period of his life. God knows my tank was empty for years. And he was supported me through that. So now his tank might be empty. Maybe it's not. Maybe he just wanted to sleep in. But if his tank is empty, can I take this burden on one day to help him out? I can talk so freely about giving and being of service for the newcomer. What kind of person am I if I can't do that in my own home for my husband? And then all of a sudden, well, you know what? This is kind of a workout anyways. I'm getting a workout in before work. You know, and maybe he doesn't have anything to give. I'm grateful that I do have this to give. And all of a sudden, self-pity turned to gratitude. And gratitude is such a better feeling. But I have to reach for it because it's not my default feeling. One of the other stories that I like to tell about him is he went hunting last year. It might have been 2 years ago. And I came home. He was already gone. And he had left a list, a to-do list. And I looked at it, and I was like, he couldn't have done this before he left? And I'm looking at the list. There's about 5 or 6 things on it. He actually left me a to-do list? He couldn't even send me a text and ask? And I just start fuming. My mind is made up on his intent, his motive, what he's asking of me, and I'm not happy about it. And I relook at the list, and you know, it's little things. Bring the rugs inside, shake them out, X, Y, Z. Winterize the yard. And I'm like, you know what, I'll just get these done. He hardly ever goes out of town, and if this is what he needs to have a fun weekend away, be of service, Diana. God's calling you to be of service for your husband so he can have a fun weekend away. It took me like 30 minutes to get it done. It really wasn't hard. But I felt like a hero because I did his to-do list, and I could not wait to tell him that I got it done. So he called halfway through the weekend, didn't mention the list. I didn't bring it up. When he called on Sunday because he was driving home, he still didn't bring up the list. So I brought it up, and I said, by the way, I got your list done. And he goes, what list? And I was like, the to-do list you left. And he goes, oh, you did that? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, that wasn't a to-do list. That was just my reminder for the next couple weekends. And I was like, happy to help. I don't know how many times I have to learn the hard way that my default feelings and emotions are usually not right. In fact, I think way too often about what I'm feeling to begin with. My hardest battle with sobriety and with life is doing what I need to do despite what I feel. And one of my favorite sayings, which is quoting somebody quoting The Pursuit of Happiness, people often mistake pleasure with happiness. Pleasure comes from doing what we feel like doing. Happiness comes from doing what we should do. I don't always do what I should do. I often pick what I feel like doing. There are times in my sobriety where I feel like being sober. I feel like being of service, and that's great because what I feel like doing and what I should do are in alignment. But that's not always the case. And when I start to chase my feelings and rest on my laurels because that's what I feel like doing today, I start to get spiritually sick. And I try to look for the signs. Sometimes for me, it's just, again, that hyperfixation on what other people are drinking, how other people are sharing at meetings. When I start focusing on other people and comparing, that's my first sign that I'm spiritually sick. For me, when I'm spiritually healthy, my default is love and forgiveness. And I'm just grateful. And whatever happens, I can find something to feel grateful in. But for me, that's not a destination. I can get that way, and then it's just gone. The next day, the next week, the next month, I can be doing everything right, and it's just gone some days. And so I'm grateful that I know that for me, sobriety and AA and my spiritual work, it can't just be a part-time thing. I had this belief that I could finish the 12 steps of AA, and I told my husband that I had to go to meetings 3 times a week. But, you know, as I got the hang of it, I'd kind of cut back. And he's like, sure. I had no idea that this was a lifelong pursuit. And as my spiritual fitness grew and my understanding and capacity grew, more was usually needed of me. I was able to give more. I'm able to find different ways to give. And then I want to do it. So the 3 times a week turns into sponsee meetings, speaker meetings, the regular meetings for the newcomers, maybe service work like Feed My Starving Children. But then even if I'm not in AA, how can I be of service to my friends and family? My sister has 4 kids, and I went to her house one time, and all I could think about and obsess about was how messy her fridge was. I mean, it was just disgusting. I would never let my fridge get that messy. Well, who am I to judge? And if I have such a strong opinion about it, why don't I offer to help? So I did. Either I can be part of the problem or I can be part of the solution. And I'm grateful that I had that thought when I drove home from my first meeting. Whether I like it or not, I'm an alcoholic. Nothing changes that. I tried it my way. I tried to cut back. I'm an alcoholic. And I can either feel bad about that and fight that thought and be part of the problem, or I can be grateful and move towards the solution. I'm so, so grateful for the people that continue to lead me and pull me by example on how to continually grow my spiritual life. And for me, it's usually a couple steps forward, step back. Couple steps forward, step back. When I first started meeting with sponsees, I had a variety of people that I got to meet. I met some people that were eager to meet every week. They were there early. They did whatever was asked of them because they were ready to be sober. And I had some people that just stopped texting. One day I went to a meeting with somebody. It was our first meeting together, and we were going to meet at a coffee shop. And she texted and said she was going to be late. No problem. You know, I'm sitting there drinking my coffee. Going to be even later. 30 minutes later. 45 minutes later. And I'm like, you know, why couldn't she just tell me she couldn't come? I could have spent this hour doing so many other things. I am so busy, and I just spent an hour sitting here waiting for her to show up. She's not considerate at all of my time. And then I thought, if somebody told me, in order to stay sober, you have to go to coffee shops sometimes, and somebody may or may not show up, but you just have to be willing to go to a coffee shop in case they show up, and that'll keep you sober, I would have done that in a heartbeat. Self-pity, gratitude. How quickly do I want to or can I move from the self-pity to the gratitude? I could tell you a million stories of how I screw up and how I try to fix it. It's my favorite thing to laugh at those things. In the moment, it's not as fun. But my goal is to trust and lean on my higher power in all things. If I have a lot of sponsees, my higher power needs me to stay focused in my program. Or there's people that he needs help with. If I don't have sponsees, my higher power wants me to spend more time with my family. And when I have that trust that whatever the circumstances are, there's something beautiful to be had in it, I have that gratitude a lot more easily. When I was younger, I used to drive around in my car, windows down, music blaring, and I would just laugh. Because life was awesome, I had my license, and I was just utterly joyful. And I thought about, as an adult, how that kind of stuff doesn't happen. It makes sense. We're adults. We got bills to pay. We have kids. And when I got sober, after a couple months, I was driving with my windows down, and I just started to laugh because life was beautiful again. And I realized I had my joy back. And I hadn't lost it because I was an adult. I lost it because I was spiritually sick. And I didn't know how to get it back. I didn't even know I was spiritually sick. And I love that AA gave me my joy back. Being sober was a great enough gift. But to be sober and joyful, not everybody has that. I've met a lot of people that are sober. Some people I've known sober for 30 years. But they don't have their joy back. And that's not good enough for me. I don't just want to be sober. I want to be joyful. I'm so, so grateful. I will end with my second favorite part of the big book. It's on page 63. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Thank you.